case number 20-1705, Katrina Woodall et al. v. Wayne County, Michigan et al. Or arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Timothy Allen Deemer for the appellant.
Mr. Deemer, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Timothy Deemer on behalf of Wayne County. Also with me is Davide Stella, co-counsel from Wayne County Corporation Counsel's office. He's here with me, but not on camera. I intend to save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. You may proceed, sir.
Thank you very much. My intent is to address the two groundbreaking novel legal issues in this case and to rest on the briefing on the fail-safe issue, which I believe is explained in adequate detail. I believe that these two novel issues are what prompted this court, including Judge Donald was on the interlocutory panel, to accept review because there are two revolutionary aspects to the decision that was reached below. I would like to start with the Monell issue in the case. It's a unique decision that Judge Tarnow made, but more importantly, it's an error of law. Judge Tarnow framed the, quote, core legal question, quote, as simply whether Wayne County had a policy or custom of tolerating unconstitutional strip searches. This is a legal error because that does not correctly and adequately address the legal standard. The legal standard requires first proof of an underlying constitutional injury. So this is unique in one way. We're gonna have the ostensibly the causation issue decided in advance of the actual injury. But even if that were appropriate, I don't think it is. The manner in which the judge framed the issue of policy or custom only is error.
Do you think any of the elements within how to prove a Monell claim? I understand them to be saying that this is an inaction case, and our case law says there are four elements in that type of case. And the first element is a clear and persistent pattern of unconstitutional conduct. Do you think that at least that could be framed as a common question under 23A2? Whether in fact there was a clear and persistent pattern of unconstitutional strip searches in the four ways that they suggest?
I do not, Your Honor. And to frame the issue in that way and to proceed on a class-wide basis in that way would result in, for example, if Katrina Woodall proved she was unconstitutionally strip searched and there was a customer policy in place and that customer policy was the driving force behind the constitutional violation, her claim would be proven, no one else's would. No one else would.
The way I would envision it is nobody's specific claims would be covered, right? So whether any particular plaintiff was subject to a Fourth Amendment violation would not be at this stage. At this stage would simply be whether there was a clear and consistent pattern of unconstitutional violations. The jury could answer that yes, no. And then that issue, the answer to that issue from the jury could be applied in all the individual cases. I recognize there may be a predominance issue, that there's going to be still a whole bunch of other elements that are in play. But that struck me as at least one common question that every plaintiff would have to prove in this Monell type claim.
I don't think that can be addressed on a class-wide basis. Setting aside the predominance issues, the case law says the policy must be in place in advance, in existence at the time the injury occurred. So if, for example, one plaintiff proves a policy and custom existed in 2021, that's not going to prove there was a policy in 2014 or 2016 or 2017. And I agree that struck me, you know, just common sense. Why can't we just certify this one question? Wouldn't it advance litigation? And my view is no, it would not. A case like, again, Judge Tarnow's decision at page 6 cited cases that rejected class certification on strip search cases. He acknowledged some courts wouldn't allow it. And he said some did. And he cited a number of district court cases in a first circuit opinion. Now, those were blanket strip search challenges where until the Supreme Court, this is kind of a long-winded answer here, sorry. The Supreme Court in 2012 in Florence versus Burlington definitively said jails and prisons may constitutionally strip search every single prisoner, every single inmate who comes through, regardless of reasonable or individual suspicion. Before 2012, it was an open question and there were different answers around the country. So some of these district courts in the First Circuit said, well, because it is unconstitutional to strip search every single prisoner without reasonable suspicion, we can certify a class because it's a blanket policy. It applies to every single individual in the exact same way, causes the same injury. A blanket policy like that would be appropriate to certify that question. But that's not what we have here. What we have here, we have a written policy that prohibits the exact conduct complained of. The policies say no group strip searches after 2013, no derogatory language may be used, no males may be present, and the allegations that those were sometimes violated. That cannot, a claim like that is not a blanket strip search policy that can be applied across the board. Every single search is going to be different, has different allegations, different time, different people, different circumstances. And there's just simply no way.
So are you saying that the mechanism that the judge used to group them into subclasses, where you do have this commonality of the strip search within the subclasses under the rubric of that broader class, that violates Rule 23 or does not satisfy the requirements to make this a case which could be certified?
Okay, I believe it violates Rule 23A, and secondly, violates Rule 23B3. Rule 23A, I believe the closest case we have to the situation we have here is Alcree versus Irving, which was a constitutional claim, a class action, unlawful detentions, there are bail issues. And this court, the Sixth Circuit, said under 23A, these claims are so wildly different that they can't be grouped all together. Okay, so that's one aspect. But then this court took an additional step, because again, Walmart versus Dukes, these cases do say Rule 23A might be satisfied with a single common question. But what this court said in Alcree versus Irving is Rule 23B3, a type 3 class action, does not allow a single common question to be certified. This court made that clear. So even if we accept that Judge Tarnow can certify the singular question on policy or custom under 23A, it still is legal error under Alcree versus Irving, which says it has to be more than one question for a B3. And it's because the additional requirements of B3. The common questions, plural, must predominate over the individual questions. So if we have a singular question on policy or custom, that does not suffice under 23B, subsection 3. And again, in addition to Alcree, the closest analog we have on the policy or custom aspect are Walmart versus Dukes, the Falcon case, Reeb, these employment discrimination cases, where the class allegations were that there was a corporate culture that tolerated sexual discrimination or whatever else they're accused of in terms of violating Title VII. And the Supreme Court said when the defendant in that case, Walmart, disputes each and every individual allegation of discrimination, that just becomes completely unmanageable on a class-wide basis. And that's the exact situation we have here. The allegation that there's a customer policy of or tolerance of constitutional violations sounds an awful lot like me to the allegation that a national corporation would tolerate sexual discrimination because of the corporate culture and not put a stamp on that.
Can I ask you a question just about, so the Monell claim requires both a clear, consistent pattern of unconstitutional conduct, but also deliberate indifference. So one of the elements, you have to have constructive notice and deliberate indifference. I'm curious, like, who is the individual that has to be deliberately indifferent to prove this type of claim? Does it have to be a policymaker like the sheriff, is the case law unclear on this question? Because I do think that this is important because it also goes to the whether you could prove deliberate indifference on a class-wide basis.
That's a great question, Your Honor. It's a question I struggle with because there is it's a little bit of a gray area. If, you know, some low-level employee were to allow this to happen, can you really impute that to the county as a whole? Who is the policymaker that have to endorse it? I believe at a minimum, you'd have to get up into the management, supervisory type of employees. And that ties into the Prison Litigation Reform Act. That's why that statute was designed to reduce the quantity of lawsuits and improve the quality. And the reason it improves the quality is a grievance creates an administrative record. It puts the municipality on notice, and it establishes who the witnesses were, what evidence might be pertinent to the allegation. And we don't have any of that here. So if we're going to allow notice of, let's just accept plaintiff's allegation is true, and there's one employee who's a rogue employee violating all the policies, but if the county's never put on notice of that, to allow that claim to go forward would be to put the county position of respondent superior liability, which is what the entire basis Monell was. We cannot allow that. A county cannot be liable for employing a tortfeasor. The county has to be shown to have deliberately and consciously chosen this course of conduct. The county would have to know this had been going on and said, we don't care. We're going to make the choice not to do anything about it and let it continue. But there, the grievances don't exist. The complaints don't exist. I don't want to jump too far into the merits of the case, but I believe you did identify a point, another problem that we have with this class action is structured.
Just on that last point, I know that there was language in the record that this officer Graham was operating a snack policy that males and females employees could come and buy snacks, which put them in proximity to the where these strip searches were occurring. Are we saying that, or are you saying rather, that an employee of one of the searches would have to complain to the officials to make them aware or make a record of some complaint about that proximity issue, which was violative of the policy if men were allowed to see the women in a stage of undress?
So I dispute the allegation itself, because there is no window in this area, and it's not a snack shop for profit. You know, different employees would keep food items there. Thing, it's not like Officer Graham had a side business of selling, you know, food to her coworkers. But there's no window to look in. But again, on this question of notice to the county, there is no notice to the county without a grievance. I mean, and that just ties right into the PLRA issue that we've raised. But it has to go to some policymaker, some supervisor, some higher up would have to be aware that this had been going on and that this was true. And Wayne County disputes that any of this ever happened. And if these were true, there would be grievances. There would be corroborating. It's not there. Wayne County's looked into this. It's not there.
Thank you. Any further questions, Judge Guy?
No.
Judge Murphy?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is it Desai?
Desi, yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Desi, okay, we're now ready to hear from you.
All right, good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Desi, may it please the court, I represent the appellees and the plaintiffs in this case. Your Honors, I'd like to pick up and start off with Judge Murphy's question. It is an inaction theory that's being alleged, and so I agree with Your Honor's observation and assessment, which is looking at the elements of that inaction theory, the common questions that can be answered by virtue of the certification is that whether there was a persistent policy or practice and whether the county had notice of such policy and practice such that, and they were deliberately indifferent to it. So those are common questions of law, in fact, to all of the members of the class. And Judge Murphy, to answer your question about the deliberate indifference, yes, I agree that there needs to be some proofs as to the deliberate indifference and notice, but that is one of the disputed elements, which again goes to the utility of granting certification on only the narrow issue of the Monell question. And so—
Is it true? In the abstract, I see when you say that you need a pattern, that suggests it should be something that's on a class-wide basis. But imagine a hypothetical, I think the named plaintiffs have claims from around the 2013 time. Imagine a hypothetical where smoking gun evidence of their knowledge came in 2017. that evidence would be completely irrelevant for members of the class from 2014 to 2016. So it's not clear to me that this can be decided on a common basis, because I just don't, how do you, one possibility would be we only look at evidence at the start of the class period. So that would be at 2014, and we don't look at any past evidence. But that strikes me as completely unfair to the plaintiffs in, like, say, 2018, where maybe new evidence was developed. So I guess that's the problem I have in thinking how this could be structured to have one answer when the facts could have changed over time.
So, Your Honor, the way I would answer that question is the way I would see that I would envision that is that by virtue of the fact that the plaintiffs have to present evidence of a policy or a persistent pattern of practice, that they would present that evidence over time. So, for instance, if they were incarcerated or if they were detained in 2013 or 14, they present those proofs, but also they present proofs from other putative or other class members that show that the policy and practice continued in 2016, 17, 18. And of course, at the end of the day, then it would be for the fact finder to say, well, you know, we've seen evidence that this happened in 2013, but no other evidence. So we don't find that there's a pattern in practice beyond that. And so they reject the Monell question and they say that the county did not have a policy in practice, in which case all of the putative class members would then be bound by that decision, which is why the certification is not fail-safe, because that certainly would benefit Wayne County in that instance. Now, on the flip side, jury could say, all right, we heard evidence of this pattern in practice in 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And so we do find that there was a pattern in practice, and that we also find that the county had notice of it. Just as an aside, you know, the counties had at least 1,000 declarations from maybe close to 1,000 declarations from inmates in this particular series of cases that had culminated in this particular case. And they've had those declarations since 2012 or 2013. So that the idea that they didn't have notice of this, I mean, that's just going to be a disputed element of the claim. And, you know, the Sixth Circuit's decision in Young says the fact that they're disputing a certain element of the claim, that's just there's nothing inappropriate about certifying a particular issue. One issue, if there is an overlap between what's being certified and there's a dispute as to that question.
What would you do? So suppose you're hypothetical about, you know, it continuing, but what would happen if a reasonable jury, based on all the evidence that is developed at trial, could find that they were deliberately indifferent in 2015 or were not deliberately indifferent in 2015? But new evidence came out and they were by 2017. Would there be jury interrogatories that you're envisioning, that year by year, month by month?
I think it could be handled a number of ways, Your Honor. I think that those are trial practice. There's tools for trial practice that could be structured to answer the specific questions. So for instance, you know, the parties, of course, when we craft instructions, we would ask for different instructions as to what constitutes the pattern in practice over time or not over time. And then a jury could be asked those certain questions. I mean, I think that's all well within the discretion of the district court for purposes of how to formulate the procedure or the particular tools or jury questions to answer that. But still, in any inaction theory Monell claim, you're going to have to prove a pattern in practice. So it begs the question, you know, you have to put proofs on over a certain range of time to answer that question. And the reason why the district court's order in this instance, the reason it predominates is it serves the utility that it serves is it answers those common questions, as the judge said of the district court. It answers the common question of whether they maintained the policy of inaction, whether they had notice of it, you know, who had notice of it, whether that could be imputed to the county. So those are the common questions that would be answered. Just like Judge Murphy, you said, okay, you would envision where those plaintiffs would have their individual claims. So if the jury found there's a pattern practice, all of the putative class members, they don't all win by default. The county can still contest whether that particular person or a particular plaintiff was subject to the type of strip search that she alleges for any number of the putative class members. It doesn't determine that as a default where they say, well, they win.
I mean, I just want to mention also to the fact that my brother counsel is mentioning that Alkire case by the Sixth Circuit. I just want to point out that that was decertified because there were damage classes that were certified by the district court. And given the variation of the restitution orders and the variation of damages in that case, the Sixth Circuit said that class certification wasn't appropriate. But we don't have those issues here because the district court did not certify any damage classes. So there won't be an issue of damage proofs, individualized damage proofs predominating over the common question. So in other words, by bifurcating it, it makes it clean and narrow to the only to the answer the issues as to the Monell inaction theory. And
answer- Can I ask you, it's not entirely clear what the district court certified. It didn't even mention the inaction theory. It just, at a high level of generality, said the Monell claim was certified. I guess I envisioned after Walmart, Walmart uses the phrase either rigorous or rigorous analysis, I think is the phrase. I would have envisioned in this type of situation, if you're going to certify a class, the analysis would have been, this is how it's actually going to work. And it's not at all clear to me how this is going to proceed. You mentioned the interrogatories. I think that's a significant issue that should have been determined at the class certification stage. Is it even feasible to have a jury answering whether a party was deliberately indifferent every month? I would have envisioned the certification going to specific elements of the claim. And it's not entirely clear here what elements have actually been certified for a class. And I would have envisioned the district court saying what's going to happen after that. Is it, you mentioned the damages phase. All these individuals have to receive notice, and then they're all going to have individual proceedings of some type, because everybody's going to have to determine what their individual damages were. You also have to determine causation. And none of this was really in the opinion. I envision like Walmart suggesting that these are the types of things that we need to be thinking about now at the certification stage rather than down the road.
So, Your Honor, the way I would answer that question is twofold. First off, the merits of the arguments are currently pending before the district court on summary judgment. And the Monell arguments in terms of the actual theory, those are pending in the summary judgment motions. And I think that certainly can be fleshed out through the summary judgment proceedings. And as we move forward, I think what is clear is that the district court was certifying the Monell question in the general sense, whether there was an inaction of policy or custom. And now as that gets framed into the particulars for purposes of how it would proceed to a fact finding, I think that would be left to the trial court's discretion in formulating and also for the parties to formulate what particular instructions would be given relevant to the Monell theory, which in this case we've alleged is the inaction. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
But you, so you're saying we don't have to consider any of those multifaceted issues posited by Judge Murphy at the threshold stage in determining whether or not this is a certifiable class. If you disagree with that, what are the kinds of threshold issues? And we all know the elements, but you know, though there are facts that we have to consider within the ambit of those threshold elements. So what do we need to consider here to determine whether or not this is a properly certifiable class? Because I would submit that we have to at least kind of consider some of those issues.
Right. So, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting you don't consider the issues that have been raised by Judge Murphy. I think the issue that has to be considered is, number one, whether there is a common question of law or fact. Broadly and generally speaking, the common question of law and fact in this instance is the Monell. And then, as I've explained in my briefs and as we're currently proceeding in the district court on summary judgment, is the inaction theory. So the particular factual question to be answered within the more broad area of Monell would be the inaction theory and the elements of the inaction theory, which is a pattern of practice, whether that practice persisted over a certain course of time, whether the county would have had notice of that, which, you know, those elements, of course, are in dispute because the parties are obviously disputing the elements of the claim. Those are the particular, the necessary particulars within the Monell that I think will have to be answered. Now, as far as what your honors have to consider, I still think we back up and say, all right, on the broad, is there a common question under Monell? And then more specifically, we can say, yes, under an inaction theory, whether there is a pattern in practice, that particular question can be answered. That would be common to all. It's, and that one question predominates over, you know, a series of individual questions. So I do think that you do consider those, but I think that the judge considered that when he said, for instance, whether the county had noticed, or for instance, whether this deputy was running a snack shop. And she did testify that she was selling these items at the room adjacent to the changeout room. So, I mean, anyway, that's in the transcripts, and that's before the district court on the merits. But those questions would then allow, those disputes, excuse me, would allow the fact finder to determine whether these particular instances of the four subclasses, whether these things have been proven as to the group of putative plaintiffs over time. So the certification order was from 2014 through to the present. So I would envision that that would then mean we have to present proofs of that pattern over time. And whether that's then broken down into something that's provided in jury instructions, that, you know, that's certainly one tool that could be used to manage those questions. And again, I think that's within the district court's discretion as the case proceeds and as there's more specific questions that have to be answered under the rubric of the Monell inaction theory, the policy and custom, whether there was an inaction of a certain pattern and practice over time. So I do think
Can I ask you just one further? I guess it's related, but a little distinct because it's about that adequacy of the class representatives. And as I understand the class representatives, at least from the complaint, their claims all actually predate the date of the class. I thought most of the strip search allegations in the complaint of the named class members were from 2013 or before. And I guess how does that make them adequate representatives of a class that postdates them? I guess is the question.
So the Judge Tarnow answered that question or sort of referred to it because he said their claims are still the same. The type of activity that they're claiming they were subjected to is still the same from that time to 2015, 16, 17, 18. So the time after those types, those particular instances of strip searches are still the same experience that these particular plaintiffs are alleging. The reason that happened that way is because they were, my particular plaintiffs were previous class members of a prior suit. And once that suit was dismissed, then they stepped forward to file suit. So there was some issues of tolling under American Pipe based on the previous case and then this case that was filed, which allowed them to still bring their claims into court. But then the judge said, but from the time that they filed in 2017, we'd go back 3 years as far as the statute. So that's the only reason why you find that these plaintiffs were incarcerated in either 2013 or 2014. And then the judge found that based on the statute of limitations that the class claims would have to be from 2014 forward, but it's still the same claim. Nobody's claiming it's something different. They're still claiming that they were either strip searched in front of men, strip searching groups, subject to derogatory comments, or subject to unhygienic conditions. So it's still the same character of the actual claim, just from a different time period. And I see that I'm out of time. If your honors have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer those, of course.
Thank you, Judge Guy.
Nothing.
Judge Murphy, thank you. Mr. Deamer, you have your full rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I believe the court really honed in on the difficulties of trying this case as on a class-wide singular question as formulated by Judge Tarnow. Judge Murphy identified the timing issues. If there's a policy or custom in 2017, should the prisoners in 2014 get the benefit of subsequent policy? And the answer is no. The case law says you can't take subsequent misconduct and on a policy or custom question and apply it earlier. So if this were to proceed in this fashion, we would have to have a further breakdown of subclasses based on timing. So we'd have four subclasses based on the type of allegation, and then those would have to be broken down in terms of timing. A lot of the questions were directed towards the superiority element under B3. And whether the district court adequately and fully examined how this case would be tried. And the one issue that I briefly touched on that Judge Tarnow decided not to decide at the time and decide sometime later was the exhaustion of administrative remedies requirement. And this is a major, major issue in this case. It's a serious defense. And plaintiff's counsel's view is it doesn't apply at all. It's never going to apply because the lead plaintiffs are foreign prisoners, then it's not going to apply to anybody. That's been his view. Judge Tarnow didn't accept that, but said we'll address it at some other point down the road. So that creates two problems. One, it creates yet another set of individual inquiries. Was the class member in prison when the suit was filed? If so, did she exhaust? If the answer is no, dismissed. If she answers yes, then we have to look at the allegations to determine what type of damages she would be entitled to seek.
Because you would agree, though, if under the plaintiff's position, it is a yes-no question. If we say it simply doesn't apply, then we could answer that uniformly under that theory.
I'm sorry, if the PLRA does not apply?
If the plaintiff's theory is of statutory interpretation is correct, that shall be brought only applies to the named class members and does not apply, the named class members and does not apply to any unnamed members. If we answer it, that's what the statute means, then there's no case by case concern. It would just not apply to all the unnamed class members.
If the United States Supreme Court tomorrow came out with that ruling, then yes, I don't anticipate that. The Rules Enabling Act and that this court has applied has said that Rule 23 cannot be used to circumvent a statutory defense that a defendant might have to be free from liability. The Stein case said in the briefing was a statute of repose. It was a legislative choice that after a certain point of time, the defendant could not be liable for whatever misconduct they're accused of. And this court said under the Rules Enabling Act, that is not allowed to sidestep that requirement of law by forming as a class action. And that's exactly what's happened here. Plaintiff's counsel had numerous cases dismissed under the PLRA. So this formulation of it was, well, let's have the lead plaintiffs be former prisoners as a way to piggyback in thousands of current prisoners. That would completely gut the PLRA. That would create an end run around the statute that could be exploited every time. And I don't believe that's what the Congress intended with the statute. Now the court has brought up American Pipe, and Mr. Desi brought up American Pipe. American Pipe, I believe, also controls the PLRA issue. In American Pipe, what the Supreme Court said was when the class action complaint is filed, every class member becomes a, quote, party, quote, to the case unless and until the class member opts out. That is how and why each class member gets the benefit of tolling of the statute of limitations when the complaint's filed. If they weren't a party, then they wouldn't get tolling because the complaint wouldn't be on their behalf. So if that is true for the statute of limitations tolling, that really ought to be true for a defense that, again, would apply to any party who brought the lawsuit. I don't think you can get the benefit of tolling under American Pipe and then not have the same rule apply on the PLRA. And if the PLRA isn't interpreted that way, then I believe that would be contrary to the intent of the legislature and the plain language. I mean, the statute used to be weaker. It used to have exceptions and excuses for not complying with it, but the legislature amended it in 1996. The Supreme Court has applied it with rigor, which requires full and complete exhaustion of grievances prior to filing suit. I believe I'm out of time. I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have.
Any further questions, Judge Guy?
None.
Judge Murphy? The matter is submitted.